So, good evening. It is a very great pleasure to welcome Professor Dan Burke to the LSE, and a great privilege that he's going to be giving these three Leverhulme lectures for us in the course of this week and next. We're obviously extremely grateful to Dan for abandoning the warmth of California to come to London, and we're also extremely grateful to the Leverhulme Trust for making this visit possible and the lectures by way of a Leverhulme visiting professorship for Dan. Dan is truly one of the world's preeminent scholars of intellectual property. His work spans copyright, patents, trademark, and not only that, he's also, I think, one of the very few intellectual property scholars, to my knowledge, who also ventures into referencing work that I suspect many other intellectual property scholars simply don't read, the work of, for example, Bruno Latour and Gilles Deleuze and so on, which is particularly a particularly interesting feature. Dan has, of course, published extremely widely in all three areas of intellectual property, and together with Mark Lemley, has published a very influential book called The Patent Crisis and How the Courts Can Solve It. In the course of these three lectures, he will be taking us through some of the emerging issues in intellectual property, principally focused on the interface between intellectual property regimes and emerging technologies. Dan is eminently qualified to talk about new technologies and property because he is trained as a scientist, as a biologist. So when he talks to us about gene patents, as he will in a moment, he knows what he's talking about. So I think on that note, I would like to welcome Dan to come and talk us through.
Thank you so much. I appreciate the very warm and perhaps overly complimentary introduction. And I am delighted to be here for this visit and for a series of three lectures on biotechnology and software patents and the innovation economy. As you heard Dr. Pataj say, we're going to start the first lecture talking about gene patents, about some of the most recent developments in that area, and as he said, quite grateful to him and to his colleagues for organizing this, to LSE for hosting the lectures, and of course to the Leverhulme Trust for sponsoring the lectures. Each year the Trust sponsors a number of lectures around the UK by visiting faculty in arts, humanities, sciences. And it's quite gratifying that they've added this year patents and innovation as one of the important and cutting-edge topics that we can think about together. So tonight we'll talk about gene patents, about biotechnology, what's happening in that area. Next Tuesday, March 10th, we then continue talking about software, which might seem to be a different topic since it's a different technology, but I hope to show you that there's a very close relationship between the two technologies and the way that they've been treated in patent law. And then finally, on the 13th, try and bring those topics together and find the commonalities and perhaps make some sense out of what seems to be rather incoherent mass of developments. Maybe not all answers will be solved, not all problems will be fixed for us, but we'll sum up and try and connect the two topics, thinking of them as being information technologies. I will talk a fair amount about American law, because you have plenty of people here who can talk about law in the UK, so it would make sense to bring in a visitor to talk about that. There are plenty of people at LSE who can do that. But it also would make sense to bring in someone just to talk about what's happening in the United States. So we're going to be very comparative. We're going to talk some about what's happened in the United States, but we're also going to look at a number of other jurisdictions. Tonight we'll talk about gene patenting in Canada and Australia. When we get to software, we'll talk a bit about what's happened in Germany and other member states of the European Union. And the idea is to try and gather out of all these different approaches and different bodies of law some common and big picture themes. So we'll take a bit of a world tour as we do this, looking for some commonalities and, as I said, looking for some coherence. As we do that, we need to think and bear in mind what the patent system does. Patents, of course, vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There are no worldwide patents. If you want to protect your invention in France, you need a French patent. If you want to protect it in Japan, you need a Japanese patent. But thanks to international treaties and harmonization, there are some similarities or commonalities among the different jurisdictions. And the discussion as to why we have patents or why we think that they're important is also becoming increasingly common, increasingly harmonized around the world. The usual story that you hear, the usual story that we tell as to why we have patents is that they are an incentive, right? That they will prompt someone to invest in innovation, both creating some new technology and then bringing it to the marketplace. This period of exclusivity that we call a patent that then follows a successful innovation allows them to recoup the cost of what they've invested in creating that that new invention and bringing it to the public. Not entirely clear that that story works. There's actually very little empirical evidence that patents do what I've just suggested to you is the most common justification. Right? It's not clear that they actually cause investment in innovation. Patents clearly cost something to society. Right? If you've got a period of exclusivity, about 20 years after something's been invented, when no one else can use it, that imposes some costs. It may well be that those costs in many or even most cases are higher than the benefit we get out of the incentive that we are hoping to give inventors and innovators. So it may be a bad bargain, right? And we just sort of don't know. Another possible reason why we might have patents is disclosure. Many people say, well, if you have a new technology, you might keep it as a secret, confidential business information, a trade secret, unless we have the ability to protect this with a patent, and then maybe you'll disclose it and share it with the rest of the world. In fact, many people talk about a quid pro quo, right? That the deal or the bargain between the public and the inventor is you disclose your patent, you tell us how to make and use the invention in this document that we call a patent, and in return we'll give you this period of exclusivity as a reward. So it's a bargain with the public. Again, not clear that that story really makes very much sense. Since, of course, if you could keep the technology secret, that lasts indefinitely, right, as long as it remains a secret, whereas the patent expires after 20 years. It may be that the only things that are being disclosed in patents are things that can't be kept a secret that would have come to the world or been discovered anyway. So it's not clear if that story makes sense either. Another possibility proposed very famously by Ed Kitch at the University of Virginia in the United States is that patents are really about coordination. He tries to compare them to rights in real property, in land. One of the reasons we give property rights, rights in land, is to coordinate the use of resources. If things are held in common, they might be overused, right? The tragedy of the commons. And so we give private property rights to try and give the resource into the hands of someone who will coordinate its use and make sure that it's used efficiently. And perhaps we do that with intellectual property as well. Again, not clear that that story works very well, because natural resources, tangible resources, are exhaustible, right? You know, there's only so much oil or so much grass to graze on or so much fish to be had in a particular body of water. But ideas don't seem to be exhaustible. And so it's not clear that we need something to coordinate ideas, as you might find in a patent, in the same way that we need coordination for physical resources. Finally, there's a possibility that we get patents in order to lower transaction costs, in order to create efficient markets and allow businesses to negotiate with each other without the fear of being held up or being having their ideas misappropriated by somebody else. So the bottom line is a number of reasons why we might have patents. We're not sure if any of them make any sense. There's very little evidence to support any of them. And I tell my students sometimes that it's a little bit like a religion. Lots of people have faith that patents are a good thing, particularly if you have a patent. You find big corporations and patent owners are sure that they must be a good thing. There's not a lot of proof for that, but they're quite passionate about it. And so it's very much like an article of faith that we need patents for one or the other of these reasons. And so we want to keep that in mind as we're talking tonight about gene patents, as we talk about software patents in the coming days. We also need to say a little bit, for those who may not be familiar with how the patent system works, about the criteria for patenting. We're going to focus tonight and in the next two lectures on the first criterion of subject matter. What kinds of things can you patent? But given what I've just told you about the justifications for patents, you can imagine that we want to set some rules or some criteria as to when we give them out. Right? If the idea is to give an incentive to innovators to invest in new technology, then we don't want to give a patent for old technology, right? We only want new technology. If we want them to invest in technology that we wouldn't have had otherwise, then we set a pretty high bar as to the kinds of technologies that get patents. If the idea is, on the other hand, to disclose technologies that might otherwise be kept as a secret, then part of the bargain between the inventor and the public must be that you give us a good disclosure, right? You give us the information in return for the exclusive rights in the patent. So we set up some rules, right? First of all, there are limits as to what kinds of things can be patented. And we're going to ask tonight, you know, can genes and other types of biotechnological molecules be patented? There's a requirement of novelty. What you apply for, what you try and get a patent on, has to be new. As I said, we're not going to give you a patent on something we already know about, something that's old, because that's not the purpose of the patent system if we want to try and encourage new technologies. So show us that it's novel. It has to be useful, or as you'd say here in European countries, has to have some sort of industrial application. We don't really want to give you a patent for something that has no use or no purpose, so you've got to tell us what that is. We don't want to give you a patent for something we could have come up easily with by ourselves or that anybody could have thought of. As I said, we set a fairly high bar. So in the United States, we call this non-obviousness. The invention cannot have been obvious to a person of ordinary skill in the technology. Here in European countries, you would say the inventive step in the European Patent Office. It has to be inventive, right? It has to be a significant step forward over the prior technology. So we're not going to give you these exclusive rights for just any invention. It has to be a significant invention. You have to disclose how to make and use the invention. That's part of the bargain, we said, between the inventor and the public. And you have to tell us what your invention is, right? So every patent ends with some statements called claims that try and set out the borders or the parameters of the rights that the inventor wants in her technology. And unlike other kinds of intellectual property, this actually has to be looked at by a state agency. Right? There's a patent office in a country where you want to get a patent. Unlike copyrights that arise spontaneously when you fix expression in a tangible medium, trademarks evolve through use and you can also register them, but a patent right only comes into existence after you've applied and convinced a government agency that you meet these criteria. So we're going to focus on the first one tonight, but keep the other ones in mind because they will come up periodically during our discussion. So as I said, I want to start talking about this question of biotechnology and software by being very comparative, and I've mentioned some of the places we're going to look at, and we'll talk first about genes tonight, and then software next time. And in order to do that, I'd like to start in Canada. Canada is a very interesting place to think about patents. Among other reasons, they're one of the few jurisdictions that combine both a common law and a civil law tradition. I guess here in the UK, Scotland is somewhat similar. But in this particular case that I want you to think about, the Harvard College case, this is the subject matter, right? This is the subject of the patent application, the Harvard Oncomouse. This is a mouse that has been genetically modified so that it is susceptible to cancer. It's had what are called oncogenes inserted into its genome. So it makes a good laboratory model for testing substances to see if they're carcinogenic, or testing different kinds of treatments to see if they help prevent cancer. Goes to prove the old joke, you know, that there's now conclusive evidence that scientists cause cancer in laboratory animals. That's what this animal is for, right? It's a model for studying cancer. Very quickly got a patent for this in the United States. Surprisingly quickly got a patent application through the European Patent Office, given the kind of resistance that there is in Europe to some types of genetically modified organisms. But when it came to Canada, they hit a barrier. Canadian Patent Office said, I'm sorry, you can't get a patent on a mouse in Canada, because the Canadian patent statute doesn't cover living organisms. And so, sorry, you might have gotten a patent in the United States, you might have gotten a patent in the European Patent Office, but no patent in Canada. This worked its way up through the Canadian courts to the Canadian Supreme Court. And the particular legal question in front of the court was, does the Canadian patent statute include, as patentable subject matter, a living organism like a mouse? Now, the Canadian patent statute lists the categories of possible subject matter for which you can obtain a patent. Right? So any new and useful art, process, machine, composition of matter, or article of manufacture is potentially patentable in Canada. Right? And it also has to satisfy the other criteria that I mentioned a moment ago of being non-obvious, being useful and novel, and so on. But first, you have to satisfy this requirement of the statute. It has to fit into one of these categories. It has to be an art, process, machine, composition of matter, or an article of manufacture. And the developers, the inventors of the Oncomouse, said, well, it's a composition of matter, right? I mean, it's a tangible thing, right? I mean, you can see it there. Cute little nose and whiskers, and it's solid. So it must fit into that category of composition of matter. And in a divided court, but the majority of the Canadian Supreme Court says, no, it's not. Not a composition of matter. Now, that sort of leaves you to ask, what could it be then, right? I mean, it has to be either matter or energy. And actually, Einstein told us those are the same thing at some level. But how could it not be a composition of matter if it is a solid, tangible mass? And the court said, well, the term composition of matter, as used in the Canadian statute, does not include living organisms. It only includes inanimate or dead matter. The common understanding of the term composition of matter, we believe, doesn't include things that are animate, things that are alive. Because there's something different, the court said, about something that is alive, you know, that has, you know, a little pink nose and whiskers. Some vital spark, you know, that's different than just being matter, right? They didn't quite say that a mouse has a soul, but they came really close to saying, you know, there's some sort of vitalism, right? There's something different about things that are alive. And so the term composition of matter in the Canadian statute does not include mice or multicellular organisms. And if it's not a composition of matter, because it's alive, then certainly it can't be a machine, right? Or an article of manufacture. Those terms don't cover living organisms either, or a process or an art, so we're very sorry. It doesn't fit into any of the categories in the statute. None of the terms that were used by Parliament, by the legislature, contemplated this technology. So you're out of luck. Sorry, no patent on the mouse in Canada. Now, part of the reason that's quite an interesting, it's interesting for several reasons, right? I mean, it's sort of the whole, does a mouse have a soul question. But from a patent standpoint, part of the reason that's very interesting from a legal standpoint is that about 30 years previously, just south of Canada in the United States, the United States Supreme Court decided a case called Diamond versus Shacklebury that addressed exactly the same question. And in fact, the wording, right, the text of the Canadian patent statute and the U.S. patent statute are virtually identical, mostly because the Canadians lifted their statute from the United States statute back in the late 1800s, and it hasn't changed much. There's one word different in the U.S. statute because we amended our statute in 1952, so it's slightly different, but it's basically the same words, same text. In this particular case, it wasn't a mouse, it was a bacterium, Pseudomonas species, if anybody cares, that had been genetically modified by Ananda Chakrabarty, that's Dr. Chakrabarty there in the slide, so that it would digest petroleum. Right. He had introduced genes into this organism so that it could use petroleum as a carbon source. It's good for cleaning up oil spills. It was used to try and clean up the beaches in the Gulf of Mexico after the BP oil spill. So that's useful, right, to help clean up the environment after an oil spill. New, right? Takes an inventive step, and so he applied for a patent. And the United States Supreme Court, the United States Patent Office, first of all, not unlike the Canadian Patent Office, decades later, said, sorry, you can't get a patent on a bacterium in the United States because it's a living organism and our statute doesn't cover living organisms. Case went up to the U.S. courts, to the United States Supreme Court, looking at the same text as the Canadian statute, and the United States Supreme Court said, well, of course it's a composition of matter. Certainly fits into the category of composition of matter. What else could it possibly be? You know, is it made out of matter? And for that matter, it might be an article manufactured, right? Because it was genetically modified, it was engineered by Dr. Chakrabarty in the laboratory. They didn't go the whole way, but I sometimes go through an exercise with my students where I say, you know, could it also be a machine? And speaking as a molecular biologist, the answer is, yeah, I could probably describe it as a molecular machine, right? A lot of what we're doing now in nanotechnology is actually based on, you know, creating machines out of the same sorts of molecular structures you have in microorganisms. Could it be a process? Yeah, I could probably describe it as a process, right? It is a bag of biochemical processes. I could characterize the bacterium, particularly its petroleum digesting characteristics, in terms of its processes. So, the Supreme Court of the United States said it certainly fits into the composition of matter and maybe into the article manufacture categories, and probably, if you have a good patent attorney, you could fit into the other categories as well. And the Supreme Court said these categories are meant to be illustrative or and inclusive, right? The United States Congress, the legislature, couldn't foresee all of the possible technologies that would come about, and so these are meant to cover, as the court said, anything under the sun made by man, right? Anything developed by a human ought to fit into one of these categories because Congress intended all sorts of new technologies to come under the patent statute. Notice, by the way, that this creates opposite defaults in reading the statute in Canada and in the United States. Right? The Canadian Supreme Court in the Harvard Mouse case says if the legislature wasn't thinking about the technology, it's not part of covered by the patent statute unless they come back and amend the statute and tell us that it should be covered. The Chakrabarty case, the United States Supreme Court, looking at the same text, says, no, the statute is intended to cover all new technologies, right? And so all new technologies will be included under the statute unless Congress comes back and tells us to exclude them. And the United States Congress has actually done that three times. They specifically said, no patents on nuclear weapons, because they didn't think that was a good technology to encourage private innovation. So you can't get a patent on a nuclear weapon in the United States. There is a system of prizes, however. If you come up with a new A-bomb in the United States, you can get a prize, cash prize, but not a patent. And more recently, they said no patents on human beings or human organisms. Those are specifically excluded. And no patents on methods of evading taxes. We might talk about that in one of the future lectures. But that's, you know, nuclear weapons, human organisms, and taxes, right? Those are the three excluded categories. Everything else, according to the Chakrabarty case, is supposed to be covered by the patent statute, right? So in Canada, right, the door is closed to new technologies unless Parliament says to open it. In the United States, the door is open to all new technologies unless Congress says to close it. Those are two very different ways of looking at the same text. But the story is not over. Back up to Canada, two, 3 years later. Another case, another genetically modified organism. This one's a little bit different. It doesn't have whiskers or a pink nose. This is genetically modified crop, canola, which we used to call rapeseed, but that sounded bad. It wasn't good for advertising, so they rebranded it as Canadian oil. That's canola plant. because you mostly get oil from it. Monsanto has a line of genetically modified crops called Roundup Ready, right? These have been genetically modified so they resist a particular herbicide that Monsanto also sells under the trademark Roundup. So you plant your crop, your herbicide-resistant crop, and then you douse the field in this herbicide, and it kills everything except the crop that has been genetically modified to resist it. So Monsanto will sell you the seeds and the herbicide. This fellow, Percy Schmeiser, is a canola farmer in Saskatchewan, Canada, Allan Plains, and he was found to be growing patented Roundup Ready canola plants without a license. In case you're wondering how that happened, you know, we're not entirely sure, but we do know that Monsanto has a one of my colleagues calls Rat on Your Neighbor program. Right, so if you think your neighbor is growing Monsanto patented crops without a license, there's a toll-free number you can call and report your neighbor, and if they catch him, you get a $500 bounty for ratting on your neighbor. So probably somebody turned Percy in for the reward. So Monsanto sued him for patent infringement. At trial, his defense was, I don't know how those plants got there. Maybe some seeds blew off a passing truck. Maybe my neighbor, you know, the one who ratted me out, upwind was growing Roundup Ready canola last year, and the pollen drifted down onto my fields and cross-pollinated my plants so that they now have the gene. But I don't know how they got there. You know, this kind of appeared in my field. Very clear that the trial court did not believe Percy's story, right? There was evidence that he had been out spraying his plants with Roundup to see which ones died and which ones didn't, and keeping the ones that that survived. So there was some evidence that he wasn't quite as innocent as he purported to be. So by the time the case got up to the Canadian Supreme Court, he had a different theory. Right? And you can imagine, based on what we just said, what the theory was, which was, hey, you told us a couple of years ago in the Harvard College case that multicellular organisms are not patentable under the Canadian Patent Act, and a plant is at least as complex an organism as a mouse. It doesn't have whiskers, but you know, still, biologically, it's a living organism, so Monsanto's patent must be invalid in Canada. You can't get a patent on a plant. Living organism in Canada. Now, there had been a change in the composition of the Canadian Supreme Court by this time, and the folks I mentioned a moment ago who had dissented from the earlier case were now in the majority, looking at Percy Schmeiser's case. And the new majority, who had been the old dissent, said, well, it's true. We did say that living organisms are not patentable under the Canadian Patent Act. They don't fit any of the categories. And that's the law in Canada. We're not going to overturn that case. But we didn't say anything about molecules. And the way that this patent is drafted, remember I said a patent has to have claims at the end that set out what you're claiming rights in. This patent is drafted in terms of a gene, a nucleotide sequence, which happens to be in a plant, it's true. But they're not trying to patent the plant, the living organism that we said you can't patent in the Harvard College case. They're patenting the gene, which admittedly is in a plant. So the patent is perfectly valid, and we're sorry, Percy, you're an infringer. They kind of fixed things to where he didn't have to pay much in the way of damages. And so now his website says that he won. Actually, he lost, but he didn't have to pay anything. Notice that under this holding, right, If I want to now patent my mouse in Canada, I presume that what I need to do is what I talked about with regard to the US checkerboard case, right? Which is describe it in the right way, right? If I want to patent on a mouse or a plant, I describe it in terms of the gene, and I don't say the word plant, I don't say the word mouse. Right? It's all about how you draft a claim. Story's not over. Now we jump the ocean to the European Union. Monsanto also produces Roundup Ready soybeans. And as I mentioned to you at the beginning of the lecture, patents are only good in the country where they've been granted. And it's virtually impossible, it's not cost effective for a company to get a patent in every country in the world. It's too expensive. So you have to make a business decision as to where you think your markets are, where you want to get protection, where you're not going to get protection. So Monsanto has patents on Roundup Ready technology in some countries, but not other countries. Some of the countries where they don't have protection are South American countries, like Argentina. So you can grow all the Roundup Ready soya you want to in Argentina without violating Monsanto's patent, because they don't have one. And in this particular case, that's exactly what happened. Roundup Ready soybeans were grown in Argentina. They were then ground into meal, which you probably use for feeding to livestock, to animals. And they were then shipped to Europe, where they entered the European Union through the port of Rotterdam. You know, when you apply for a patent in the European Patent Office, you don't come out with a European patent at the end, you come out with a bundle of national patents. Usually people ask for three, possibly four patents. Right? They want a German patent, they want a French patent, sometimes they want a UK patent, not always, and they want a Dutch patent. Why do they want a Dutch patent? Well, if I control Rotterdam and Hamburg, I basically control most of the shipping coming into Europe, right in the continent. So the soy meal shows up in Rotterdam. Monsanto says, all right, we didn't have an Argentinian patent to stop this from being grown in Argentina, but we sure do have a Dutch patent. And so we're going to sue in the Netherlands to keep this stuff out of Europe as violating our Dutch patent. This worked its way up through the Dutch courts and eventually ends up in the Court of Justice of the European Union, because the question that was presented was, you know, can the Dutch patent, consistent with EU law, and in particular consistent with the biotechnology directive in the European Union, cover a gene that's in soy meal? The argument that Monsanto presented was, this isn't a plant. In fact, it isn't even a bean anymore. It's been ground up into soy meal. But remember from the Canadian case, their patent is drafted in terms of the nucleotide sequence, in terms of the gene that resists Roundup. And if you look in the soy meal, you can find that molecule where it was ground up from the plant. So soy meal with that gene is coming to the Netherlands, and Monsanto says we want to keep that out. We think our patent prevents that. Court of Justice of the European Union looks at the biotechnology directive and says, now, Dutch patent can't cover that. Because Article 9 of the biotechnology directive says that you can patent a gene in a European Union country, but only where the gene, quote, performs its function, end quote. And the gene isn't performing its function in the soy meal, right? Soy meal is dead, right? It's not like a mouse, it's not like a plant. So it's not doing anything there. I mean, if you brought the plant in, it would be functioning in a plant, so that would be covered. But soy meal, in this case, it's, they said, mere technical information. Right? It's not something that's patentable under the biotechnology directive. You can't patent that nucleotide sequence in isolation. Notice that the drafting strategy that works so well in Canada now backfires. When the soy meal comes in to the European Union. So that leads us from mice to canola plants to soy plants to genes. And if you've been paying attention to the news, that's been a very hot topic recently, particularly back in the United States. You may have read about the Association for Molecular Pathology versus Myriad decision from the United States Supreme Court dealing with a gene sequence, with a nucleotide sequence, and its patentability under the U.S. statute. In particular, the genes in this case don't have to do with resistance to Roundup. They are, again, oncogenes, like the genes that were inserted into the Harvard mouse. These are the genes that occur in humans, and certain mutations, certain variations on these genes, predispose women to ovarian and breast cancer. Right? The genes are called BRCA1 and BRCA2. And having located that gene, the Myriad company created a test, you know, so that if you, particularly if you're Ashkenazi Jewish descent, and at risk for this type of breast cancer, a sample could be sent to them and tested to see if you have a variation on the gene that would predispose you to breast cancer, and that would tell you and your physician something about your risk of developing that kind of breast cancer. So the patents here were drawn to a number of different formulations of the nucleotide sequence, and also two methods of testing that to see if someone is predisposed to cancer. The patents were challenged by a coalition of organizations, including the American Civil Liberties Union, as not being part of patentable subject matter. You remember I said that in the Chakrabarty case, the United States Supreme Court said, oh, these four categories in the U.S. statute are intended to cover anything under the sun invented by a human. The contrapositive of that statement is that the patent statute doesn't cover things under the sun not made by a human. And the argument here was, this is not made by a human, right? This is a DNA sequence that's found in human beings. So it's not an invention. It was a discovery. It was extracted from humans, but it wasn't created by Myriad or anybody else. So it can't be patentable. It can't fit in any of those categories because it's not something that was invented. Trial judge agreed. Said, yeah, I think that both the claims to the gene and the claims to the methods for testing the gene are invalid. We're going to focus on the former here, on the claims to the gene. The judge said, you know, this is not an invention. It exists in nature. It's a product of nature. Myriad said, well, you can't actually go out in nature and find this gene in isolation. You know, it's different. We removed it from its natural state, isolated it, characterized it, and made it available to use in a test. That's something different than what you find in the state of nature. And the judge said, well, I think the information is the same either way. It's the same genetic information, whether it's in a human chromosome or out of a human chromosome. Same thing. This was then appealed, right, to the United States Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit, which, as some of you know, is the court in the United States that hears all patent cases, all patent appeals. So it's kind of the patent court for the United States at the appellate level. And a panel of three judges reviewed the trial court's decision and agreed on some things and disagreed on other things. All the judges agreed with the trial court that the process claims were invalid, you know, the method of testing for cancer. We'll come back to that, probably not tonight, probably we'll talk more about that next week. But focusing, as I said, on the gene patent, on the molecules, said just purifying something is not enough to give you a patentable invention. Just sort of, because that's really just taking out of nature, that's not a human invention. And there were two kinds of molecules at issue in the case, as I mentioned a moment ago. One, genomic DNA, is the gene as it is, you know, found and then removed from a human chromosome. The other is a laboratory version, a synthetic version, called complementary DNA, or cDNA. And I can describe the method for making that to, you know, any questions and answers, or you know, as much as anybody wants to talk about that. But essentially, you have made this in a test tube. You take out mRNA transcript, you reverse transcribe it, and you get a synthetic laboratory-created molecule. All the judges agreed, disagreeing with the trial judge, that the synthetic laboratory-produced cDNA, that was patentable. What they disagreed about was the genomic DNA, the sequence as it comes out of the human chromosome. Judge Lurie, who wrote the principal opinion, and who, by the way, is an organic chemist, said, I think that this is patentable, because it is structurally different than what you find in the human body. In the human body, it's part of a huge molecule, chromosome, and it's been removed, and that means its chemical structure is different than what you find in the human body. So I think that makes it patentable. Just purifying it wouldn't be enough, but isolating it creates a different structure. Judge Moore, who, by the way, is an electrical engineer, agreed that it was patentable, although she said, I'm not sure I buy the structural argument. And again, I can talk about that in any degree that people can stomach. She said, I think it does different things. It's functionally different. You can do things with it you couldn't do with it when it was in the body. For example, use it for a breast cancer test. So I think that makes it patentable, but it's functionally different. Judge Bryson, the third judge, said, I don't think it's patentable at all. I agree with the trial judge about this one. I think that, as he said, it's like snapping a leaf off of a tree and trying to patent a leaf. It's just sort of found out there in nature. Notice that Judge Lurie is really telling us that he thinks it's patentable because, going back to our patentability criteria, it's novel, right? It's a new molecule, something you don't find out in the state of nature. Judge Moore is telling us that she thinks it's patentable because it's useful, right? It has utility or industrial application. You can do things with it you couldn't do it when it's in the state of nature. And Judge Bryson essentially thinks that it's obvious, right? There's no inventive step. Now, supposedly we're talking about subject matter, but they've started bringing in these other criteria that I mentioned to you would be important. So the argument was really about whether this is natural or not natural. Right? Is it something that was invented or discovered? Hard to have an intelligent discussion about that because the argument from nature both proves too little and proves too much. Right? You know, genes, just the concept of genes, is a human construct. Right? There's nothing in nature that says this is a gene, you know, or the gene starts here and genes ends there. That's something that humans came up with. So every time humans touch something or invent something, they're extracting things out of nature. Humans always are changing things in order to invent. And so if that's true, then, you know, in some sense, everything is, all inventions are a product of nature. Or perhaps no inventions are a product of nature because what humans are doing is very natural. Beavers build dams, bees build honeycombs, and humans build semiconductor chips. Right? And that's sort of how nature works. Interestingly enough, the Obama administration, the president's lawyer, the Solicitor General, filed a brief saying that they did think that the gDNA should be patentable. Said, you know, this phrase has appeared in a lot of the news reports. If you had a magic microscope, so you could look at the what you found in the human cell, you would see the same nucleotide sequence as is claimed in the patent. That's, by the way, blatantly false, right? That the sort of magic microscope test got a lot of discussion. Does the product of nature argument work here? Prove too little, prove too much? The United States Supreme Court looks at this and says, we agree with Judge Bryson and the trial judge. We think this is unpatentable as a product of nature. They specifically said, we think Judge Lurie is full of cracked ice. This whole thing about, being structurally different, we think doesn't matter. For the gDNA, what's really important, as the trial judge said, is that the information is the same, right? The nucleotide sequence is the same in the patented molecule as it would be in the human chromosome. But they said, we actually do agree with all the judges in the Federal Circuit, the three judges below, that the synthetic cDNA is patentable. Even though it has the same information, it has a different structure, being a synthetic molecule, than the genomic DNA did. And that makes it different enough to be patentable. Now, notice, first of all, that this opinion makes no sense whatsoever. Right? The first half of the opinion says the genomic DNA is unpatentable because it has the same information as you find in nature. We don't care about the structure, Judge Lurie. The second half of the opinion says, but the cDNA, that's patentable. Why? Well, because even though it has the same information as you find in nature, it has a different structure. So what is it? Is it structure or is it the information? If a client walked into my office and said, I've got this molecule, can I patent it? I'd say, I don't know, right? If I read the first half of the Supreme Court of the United States opinion, I would say, that I need to look at the information in your molecule, but if I read the second half of the opinion, I say I need to look at the structure, and I'm not sure which it is. Pretty clearly what they were trying to do was leave something for the biotechnology industry. Okay, you guys can have the cDNA for your medical techniques and your inventions in biotechnology. But not the genomic DNA. You get the sense from the oral argument that they felt that was important for research, so they tried to split the baby. Right? No patents on the genomic DNA, so the researchers can do their thing, but we'll allow patents on the synthetic cDNA so that the industry will have something to patent. Now, my friend Glenn Lunny likes to point out that apparently nobody reads the Bible anymore because King Solomon did not split the baby. Right? King Solomon threatened to split the baby. Right? Splitting the baby is bad for the baby, for the mothers, for everybody. So you don't want to split the baby. Nonetheless, that's what they did here. Right? So you should maybe go back and read a little more Bible. Now, in case you think this is just an American problem, you should realize from what I've said about the Monsanto versus Sefter case, it's not. Article 5 of the EU Biotechnology Directive that I mentioned before, right, about Article 9, Article 5 says, an element isolated from the human body or otherwise produced by means of a technical process, including the sequence or partial sequence of a gene, may constitute a patentable invention, even if the structure of that element is identical to that of a natural element. So, you know, the United States appears to have parted ways with its trading partners in the European Union. Probably Article 5 was there because the European Patent Office and the European Union and member states of the European Union felt it was important to try and be compatible with what had been U.S. law for 30 years of granting patents on genes. And suddenly now we don't. There was also quite a disagreement between the UK and some of the other member states about putting this into the biotechnology directive. So, you know, at least by the text of the Article 5, we're now doing something different in the U.S. And in the EU. The European Patent Office, you know, sort of, although it's not an EU body, nonetheless pays attention to what happens under EU directives, and so they're implementing Rule 23C. It says, biotechnological inventions are patentable if they concern biological material which is isolated from its natural environment or produced by means of a technical process, even if it previously occurred in nature. So, genes, patentable, according to the EPO, under the European Patent Convention, patentable under European law, under the Biotechnology Directive, but no longer patentable in the US. Finally, it was a bit of a coda. We shift now, I told you we spent a little bit of time in Australia. Subsequent to the US case, Myriad, same company, was challenged on the same patents in Australia. About a year after the US decision, the intermediate full federal court in Australia looked at the Myriad patents and said, we think they're good in Australia. Now in Australia, they particularly looked at Section 18.1A of their Patent Act. The question was, you know, are these genes a manufacture under the Australian statute? And there's Australian case law, there's precedent that says, well, if there is an artificially created state of affairs, quote unquote, and the invention has utility in a field of economic significance, that makes it a manufacture. And the Australian federal court said, well, we think that this is artificial. In fact, they specifically said, we kind of like what Judge Lurie said in the United States in the Federal Circuit, the intermediate court decision, about taking the DNA out of the human body, making it structurally different. That's an artificially created state of affairs. Certainly has economic significance and utility. You can test people for breast cancer, and that's significant. We don't care what the United States Supreme Court said. We think that they were looking at a different statute, and they were wrong anyways. They should have listened to Judge Lurie, and actually quoted the lower court, the intermediate court in the U.S., with some approval in reaching this decision. Now, there's now an attempt to appeal this to the Australian Supreme Court. They have discretion whether to take the case or not. It's not clear whether they're going to take the case, so this might be the final word. Or we might get an opinion from the Australian Supreme Court, either upholding this or going the other direction. That's sort of the latest question. So where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us with the United States significantly now out of step with its other trading partners in terms of patenting genes. It leaves us with this question about structure and function, right, which I said is a problem in the U.S. case, and you saw the same language in the EU biotechnology directive about structure, you know, which is important here, leaves us to see what other jurisdictions besides Australia, perhaps, will say on the subject, and this very, very sort of sticky philosophical question about products of nature. I will take up all of those questions further, believe it or not, talking about software next time, and then, as I said, try and tie it all together in a week. But in the meantime, we wanted to leave some time for your questions. You're gonna moderate this?
I'm not sure that I need to, but if you would rather.
Okay. Let loose. Yes, ma'am.
The Monsanto case.
Yes. Which Monsanto case? We have two or three.
Yeah. So the Bering decision. I'm particularly interested in your reflection on the European one. This is going the right way.
So. I am told, I'm going to start with what I'm told by colleagues in Europe, right? That the opinion is an outrage because it muddles different parts of the biotechnology directive and sort of muddles the question of patent validity and patent infringement. Right? You know, so we really shouldn't be reading Article 9, this language about where the gene performs its function in light of some of the other recitations earlier in the biotechnology directive that the court does. I'm really fascinated by it for a couple of reasons. Number one, this question, which I'm going to come back to in the next couple of lectures about where the court says, it's really just mere technical information if it's not performing a function. Right? Seems to create a special purposive restriction on gene patents in the European Union. And I'm not particularly outraged by it, and perhaps folks here feel similarly. The people who are most outraged are my civil law friends, right? It looks to me like very good common law statutory interpretation to look at the whole document and read terminology from one part of the document in light of other parts of the purpose of the document. So I kind of think it's an interesting outcome from a doctrinal standpoint. Now, from a practical standpoint, it's a disaster, right? I think, right? Because, and again, my friends on the continent, I'm not sure agree with this. If it's really the case that the patent can only cover the gene where it performs its function, so when it's active in a plant, or if it was a different kind of gene active in an animal, I assume that I can bring in, test tubes full of this nucleotide sequence, and Monsanto or the patent holder can't do anything about that because it's floating in solution and not performing a function. And the court specifically rejects the idea that it has the potential to perform a function. Sort of limiting it to that particular purpose in that particular way seems to gut the patent, which I think may be what they sort of intended to do. But from a practical standpoint, it really makes me wonder, what good does the patent do the patent holder? How can you enforce it? I mean, unless somebody actually walks in to Rotterdam with the plants or the mouse or whatever is in their hand. But doctrinally, I sort of find it very appealing or interesting the way that they read it, almost the way that a common law court would. But responsive. Too late. Everyone's asleep. No. Oh, yes, sir. Yeah.
The U.S. Supreme Court, when they're considering patent problems, they seem to take very little notice of the statute. They constantly go back to judicial exceptions, which seem to arise, at least in part, from judicial dicta of the 19th century, frankly, patent laws developed. It seems very curious, but it is necessary to repeat in every case of this kind that laws of nature are unpatentable. I don't think there's another country in the world who feels it necessary to have an exception for patenting the laws of nature, because they can see that this is not the sort of thing that you can patent. They're not new from start. Maybe unknown, but they're not new. So can you explain that they feel that the Constitution bears on this because it says you can only protect discoveries? Is that the basis of it?
So that's about three questions. I'll try and pack them all and address them. The law of nature exception doesn't show up in the U.S. patent statute anywhere. The U.S. patent statute, as I described it to you, and the Canadian patent statute that I described it to you, are sort of positive, right? They tell you things that are patentable. They say nothing about things that aren't. And the categories of things that aren't, as you say, are judicial constructions. Now, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, but you know, one of the things that I'll point out next Tuesday is the European Patent Convention is the exact opposite. Right? It gives you nothing about what is patentable. Instead, all it does is list the exceptions. And so it takes the exact opposite approach. And the Supreme Court, is very interested in judicial exceptions, and you can think of that in a couple of ways. First of all, essentially everything in the American patent statute was created by judges. So all of the doctrines of non-obviousness and other kinds of things that I mentioned that are in the U.S. patent statute were originally created by the courts back in the 19th century, and then many or most of them were codified by the legislature, mostly in 1952. So you can look at that in a couple of ways, right? You can say, well, one way to read the statute is Congress took the parts that it likes, codified them, and everything else is now gone, right? Because they didn't explicitly say that they were adopting, for example, the exceptions that you mentioned. But there's another canon of statutory construction that goes the other direction, right? Where you could say, well, since Congress didn't explicitly say that they're getting rid of all the other stuff, everything goes on just as it did before 1952, and so we continue to use all of the judicial exceptions and other common law that was developed prior to that. And the Supreme Court's much more likely to take that position, right? Unless the legislature has explicitly said, we don't want this anymore, we're getting rid of this, they will tend to follow their own precedent. What's really going on in most of these cases, right, because you sort of mentioned U.S. Supreme Court decisions, is a there are politics at two levels. Right? The Federal Circuit that I mentioned, the U.S. Patent Court, came into existence in 1982. Right? Congress said, we want to have sort of one centralized court that will develop patent law for the entire country. And the Supreme Court, for about 20, 25 years, essentially didn't take any patent cases. And justices of the Supreme Court have said, you know, sort of off the record or in private conversations, you know, this is a new court. Congress empowered it to hear about, you know, to decide patent cases. We thought we should stay out of it and let them develop their jurisprudence, which we did for 25 years. And now that they have thoroughly mucked things up, it's time for us to come back and fix things. So virtually every, so there were 20 years with no U.S. Supreme Court cases in patent, no U.S. Supreme Court decisions in patent law. Suddenly, we have four or five a year for the past several years, which on a docket of no more than 60 cases, right? The court takes about 60 cases a year. You know, given everything else that they do, criminal law, environmental law, is a pretty significant chunk of their docket. And virtually all of them are reversing or overturning what the lower court has done, right? Because they are trying to bring the Federal Circuit into line, right? And this is no different, right? This is sort of specifically said, Judge Lurie, you're nuts. What you guys are doing is wrong down there. You should pay more attention to our 19th century opinions. And there are lots and lots of other cases along the same lines, some of which I'll talk about next week. So that's part of what's happening. I said it's politics at two levels, though, because the other very curious thing about this particular case, the Myriad case, is that I mentioned Obama's magic microscope. Right? The Solicitor General, who is the attorney representing the United States, filed a brief saying we don't think that these genomic DNA sequences should be patentable. That's very strange. Why is it very strange? Well, because for 30 years, a federal agency, the United States Patent Office, had been granting patents on genes. So essentially, the administration was taking a position contrary to itself. Rather than listening to its agency that has expertise in patents, that these are patentable, it took a different position. And what we understand happened was that the research arm of the administration, the National Institutes of Health, got control of the discussion in the White House and convinced the administration that this was bad for research. So they essentially, you know, chucked the patent office, the commissioner of patents out, said, no, we're going to do what we're being told to do by the research institutes, and filed a brief contrary to the patent expertise of the administration, which you don't see happen very often. So there's some other politics happening there as well in this particular case. But that's what's happening there. Yeah. Yes, sir.
So has any court actually figured out what the dividing line is then between just a random series of sequences of information and life? Since they seem to like to keep life separate from patents.
So I didn't go very deeply into, you know, the very, very complicated situation under both the EU Biotechnology Directive and the European Patent Convention. I sort of alluded to it when I said Harvard and DuPont, who's the licensee for the Emico mouse, very quickly got a patent in Europe on the mouse, right? But that was because it was sort of determined that this was more important to help people who have cancer than to make mice suffer, right? And you have to do that calculus, actually, under the requirements in the European Patent Office. So there's sort of very, very complicated questions about whether you can patent plant varieties, whether you can patent mice or other higher organisms. And there's a whole balancing you have to go through with regard to the morality of it and whether the, it causes undue suffering to the mouse and so on. So I think the answer is no, right? Everyone is still sort of struggling with this at one level or another. I think the one thing that's becoming clear is that thinking about this in terms of products of nature is not very productive, right? For reasons that I suggested, right? What does it mean to be part of nature or not part of nature? And so what the United States Supreme Court tried to do in the Myriad case, I'm not sure they were successful, but it's, you know, probably heading in the right direction, is to say, really what we need to do is think about this in terms of the purposes of patent law that I mentioned at the beginning of the lecture. Right? You know, is this something that is better for society or worse for society? And the way that they couched that was in terms of downstream innovation. Right? If this is something that is so fundamental, a law of nature, a product of nature, that other people in the future will not be able to innovate or invent without having access to this material or access to this concept, then we shouldn't grant a patent on it. Right? So we have to sort of think about preempting future inventions, right? Are we tying up or locking up something fundamental? Now, that's not a very easy calculus to go through either, right? But at least you know what you're talking about, right? At least you know, okay, well, so we're being very utilitarian and we're asking about, you know, do we come out with more innovation or less innovation? Do we come out better or worse? As opposed to this sort of philosophical question of, what's the nature of the universe, and what's natural and unnatural? I'll say a little bit more about this next Tuesday. But the assumption, for example, about laws of nature, that they're sort of embedded in the fabric of the universe, actually doesn't stand up to philosophical scrutiny very well, right? I mean, most people who study the philosophy of science would tell you, laws of nature are human constructs, right? You know, we don't really know what nature does. It doesn't do that. It's useful for us to think of it that way. And so if all we're talking about is human constructs, you know, the Supreme Court of the United States is probably right in saying, well, is that a construct you want to lock up with a patent, reward with a patent, or is it something that other people are going to need, so we don't want to give it a patent? That's how they tried to couch the myriad discussion. And as I said, I'm not sure they were successful, but that seemed to be a more fruitful way to approach it than sort of fuzzy questions about you know, the Big Bang and the cosmic egg and all those kinds of things. So we might be making some progress. We'll find out by the end of the lecture series. Yes, Nan?
Maybe applying the presence of nature doctrine is not so fruitful and useful. But in a system like the US one, patent system, where you don't have a statutory exceptions, like in Europe, this is the only way, for example, for people like in the Myriad case, like researchers or patients challenging a patent to have a chance. I mean, what do? You just try to, in a way, to criticize or to argue that this is not patentable such a matter. And then is also patent engineering is very much questionable since the 90s, also legal scholars and biologists have asked themselves whether, well, patent engineering would contribute to promote progress and innovation or not. Is it any way an obstacle to research and also to find new cures for patients?
Yeah. So again, at least two questions there, and I'll try and unpack them. There may even be three answers to that. First of all, I disagree with the premise. Judge Rich, who was one of the drafters of the U.S. 1952 patent statute, who's now passed away, and he was also a judge on the Federal Circuit, said a number of times, I think correctly, subject matter is a loser. Right? You know, we should not be arguing about subject matter. The question under the U.S. statute is very simple. Right? Is it one of those four things, right? Is it a process? Is it an article of manufacture? Is it a composition of matter? Or is it which one did I forget? Process, composition of matter, article of manufacture, and machine, right? It's one of those four things, and then you're done. How do you exclude bad things? Well, you have all those other doctrines that I talked about, right? Novelty, inventive step, utility. And as I pointed out, that's where the judges in the Federal Circuit went when they were trying to define subject matter. Remember? Judge Lurie says, well, I think it's patentable because it's novel. Well, I thought we were talking about subject matter. Well, he's talking about novelty now. Judge Moore says, I think it's patentable because it's useful. Well, wait, I thought we were talking about subject matter. She's talking about utility. Judge Bryson says, I don't think it's patentable because it's obvious. It's like taking a leaf off of a tree. Well, what's that to do with subject matter? What it has to do is that the subject matter has no content. There's nothing there. And Judge Rich said, well, just recognize that and move on, and you're patentable or unpatentable on the basis of those other doctrines. Is it novel? Is it non-obvious? Is it useful? Did you disclose properly? And we exclude things on those basis, which is what we're ending up doing anyway in subject matter. Right? So those are the actual screens. Subject matter is kind of a loser. In terms of you know, the utility of gene patents, you know, two answers. Number one, remember that we're talking now about technology that is 25 or 30 years old. Right? So, you know, at the time that Myriad got its patents, right, even if they hadn't been invalidated 2 years ago, they would expire this year. Right? So this is more than 20 years ago. At the time, it was actually very important to be able to get a patent on a gene. But today, it's not. Right? People in the industry tell me, you know, people who do medical testing, we really don't care about the Myriad case. Myriad case is not important. Having a patent on a gene doesn't matter to us anymore. They're much more worried about a different case, which I'll talk about next week, the Prometheus case, which invalidates medical processes. Right? That's a big deal to them. But the Myriad case, they said, we don't care. That's old technology. We're fighting about something that happened 30 years ago. Second, we have pretty good empirical evidence from Wes Cohen at Duke and some other people that despite issuing thousands of gene patents, there doesn't appear to be actually any impediment to research or to development in the biotech area because everybody ignores them. Right? You know, they actually went out and did surveys of biotech companies and managers of biotech companies and said, you know, are you worried about infringing somebody else's patent on a gene? And they said, no, not really. I mean, we all have kind of a gentleman's agreement that, yeah, we have all these patents and we're just going to sort of ignore them and do our work anyway. Which is a different conversation, different discussion, but there are actually quite a number of industries that work that way. So, for example, semiconductors, lots of patents. I've actually been on phone calls, you know, where Intel says to AMD, we think you're infringing one of our patents. Right? And AMD says, well, we've got a portfolio of about 2,000 patents, and I'm sure you're infringing one or another of them. So why don't we just cross-license each other and you go away? Right? And so they have these informal agreements that they're going to continue to innovate, despite the fact that there are lots of patents floating around. The patents are mostly to defend yourself with if somebody else comes up and threatens to sue you. Right? So at least empirically it appears that having these patents in the gene area hasn't really done much to research or to innovation. So why do we care? Why do companies want them so much? Financing. Biotech startups, at least in the United States, and my understanding is true elsewhere as well, if you don't have a patent, you cannot get a venture capitalist to give you startup funds. VCs really like patents. Who knows why, right? But they're being used for business purposes that have really nothing to do with the licensing or with the justifications I set out at the beginning about innovation and so on. Instead, they were approved to somebody who would give you funding. It was like, look, I have a great thing here. I'm smart enough to get a patent. And then they give you millions of dollars and you can start your company. So a very, very different kind of use of patents than what we had expected. Yes, sir. Wait for the mic.
Given what you just said about investment in venture capital, what is the likely effect of Myriad on this?
Well, so again, Myriad, most of the research was actually done at the University of Utah, right? And Myriad is literally a stone's throw from the university research park. The patents were very important to them to get venture capital to start up. At this point, they don't seem to really care that much, right? I mean, they're still very interested in their process patents, and they've sued other people who they think have infringed their process patents. But number one, the technology has changed. Nobody really wants to offer single allele, sort of single trait testing anymore. It's all multiplexed. Right? So they're now offering a totally new product, you know, which is we'll test you for breast cancer and, you know, big ears and nose warts and, you know, whatever other kind of genetic test you want to have in a big panel of tests. And again, this is a little off the topic, but interesting. They've talked a little bit about their business strategy, particularly in Europe. And they said, you know, we actually are going to try and compete on the basis of trade secrets. So they have a very large database of all the variants of this particular gene. Having done the test for 20 years now, and they said, as a consequence, we know more about the variations and the different alleles on this gene than anybody else, and so we think we can offer a more comprehensive test than anybody else who's coming into the market. So we're going to compete now, at least with regard to this test, on the basis of our data, of our confidential information, which was their plan because, as I said, the patents were going to expire anyways. That actually leads to some interesting questions about database protection and confidentiality, sort of outside the lecture, but that's their current strategy. The patents were important to get financing to start up. At this point, not so important.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So you started off by saying that the Murray case has caused this conflict between U.S. and the rest, the other jurisdictions, basically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then you're also saying that, so from what I gather, the genomic DNA doesn't really matter anymore. So we're
yes.
looking at cDNA, and then we're looking at biotech. Biotech would be looking at, they've changed the DNA sequence anyway. So that's what they were done. And so does it really matter that
yeah,
conflict there?
Yeah, it does. So, and here's the problem, right? The problem could come up in two places. The first obvious one, right, is the human genome has basically been published, right? We pretty much know, the information is all in the public domain. Nobody's getting any more patents on that. So who cares about human genes? I've actually had people say that to me. They go, well, there are a lot of other organisms on the planet. And whether or not you can patent a gene sequence or some type of nucleotide sequence from, that interesting slug that you found at the bottom of the ocean that turns out to be really important for cancer research or cure AIDS or whatever, sequences from other organisms that haven't been thoroughly investigated, those could turn out to be important. So that's the obvious one. The less obvious one and the more important one is what I pointed out to you about structure versus information. And I don't think the Supreme Court of the United States thought this through at all. How does that play out with regard to other macromolecules? Or for that matter, even small molecules? Right? So, big scare in the United States right now, big scare in other countries about antibiotic-resistant microorganisms. We desperately need more research in antibiotics. Oh, I found some interesting new antibiotics in the dirt. This is actually how they used to find antibiotics, right? You give somebody a plane ticket, you say, you fly around the world, collect dirt, bring it back, and we'll grow things up and see if they have any interesting antibiotics. Right? So I found some really interesting antibiotics in the dirt in South Africa or something. Is that a product of nature? Can I get a patent on it? Is it based on what its structure is, or is it based on the information in it? It's not really a macromolecule like DNA, so I'm not sure it has information. I mean, it has information to some degree. It's not clear what this means for small molecule chemistry. It's not clear what it means for antibodies. We're starting to see cases in the United States challenging antibody patents, challenging stem cell patents, on the basis of the myriad holdings, saying, well, these are just products of nature. There are repercussions in the chemical industry generally, in the other areas of pharmaceuticals, other types of biotechnology research. We don't know how this is going to play out because the opinion is at odds with itself, right? It's not clear what the criterion is. So we're in a period of real uncertainty. Other places, Australia, European Patent Office, where it's pretty much business as usual, not such a problem. Right? We have some kind of weird decisions in Europe about stem cells, but we know what those are, right? We have some complicated rules, as I mentioned before, about patenting organisms in Europe, but we know what those are. The apple cart hasn't been upset there. So being out of sync in that way is important for other things besides nucleotides. And I'm getting the hook here. Do we have time for one more? Got one more. Before I come back to you, I think there might have been one more hand. Was there one more hand?
I can help, but I can.
Shoot. Yeah.
Okay, fine. Speak loudly.
Here comes the mic.
I have a theory for very small t.
Okay.
That looking at patentability in terms of the criteria makes it easier to get a patent. because you involve the person's behavior. It's an invitation to draw in a different kind of evidence, where the question is a matter of degree rather than kind. Whereas eligibility questions are, you know, bright line rules, mm-hmm. and are much more difficult to navigate for a potential applicant. So in this context, what do you think about this sort of bleeding we see from eligibility into eligibility criteria? I think with media, they're not very careful about keeping the two entirely separate. We see that with software in the EU. That's been a matter of concern. We keep it separate. So do you think this is inevitable, or do you think we should be fighting to keep them separate?
I think we need to keep them separate, right? And I didn't put her up to this, right? This is the topic of the next lecture, next Tuesday. We talk about software in particular. The European Patent Office looking at software, I think, has done, after 30 years of fighting a losing rearguard action on patentable subject matter, appears to have said, forget it. If you have anything that is tangible, we're going to say it's patentable subject matter, and then we're going to kill you on inventive step, right? Much as I told this woman earlier. Harder to do that in the United States, right, because of the way that our non-obviousness doctrine is formulated, and that's why I think the Supreme Court, as I'm going to say next time, has moved that test into subject matter so they can do that first, and not subject to some of the constraints that we have in our statute under Section 103. And so the heavy lifting, the hard work is being done by those eligibility doctrines rather than not being done by subject matter, being done by the other criteria, both in software and I think increasingly in biotech as well. Right? So I think that means I agree with you, but I think that's what's going on. He's very insistent. Yes, okay.
I was wondering if you could possibly answer this question. It does seem that...
Almost certainly not. But
it seems that patents serve a very single interest, like of the company or the person getting them. So when awarding a patent, is there ever any ethical consideration put into whether or not the certain patent should be left free for the greater benefit of the jurisdiction so that there's more innovation on it rather than constraining it to one company, or is the patent seen to serve that? Or?
That's a complicated question. My sense is there's more and more consideration of that kind of calculus, but it tends to happen after the fact. So to give you a concrete example, Tesla, right, the electric car manufacturer in the United States, recently said, we're going to disclose all of our technology to other automobile manufacturers. We hope you use it. Have fun, guys. Although they hold patents on it. Right? So the strategy was, get the patents first, and then we can decide, do we want to enforce them or not? Somebody is abusing it or doing something weird with it, we always have the option to come back in. But once we have the exclusive rights in our hands, then we can be generous and give it away. Right? That actually happened in biotech as well. Very early on, the National Institutes of Health in the United States said, "Well, we're going to try and patent all these genes, and then we'll let everybody use them." Right? But we just want to make sure, that sort of we're in control. Right? So the strategy seems to be, get the patent first, and then we can be generous and magnanimous and let you use it without enforcing the patent if we want to.
Would that not be an indication, though, that the patent shouldn't have necessarily been awarded in the first place?
You mean on policy grounds, right? That we don't need to have the patent to.
Yeah.
No. I mean, doctrinally, the patents presumably meet the criteria that we're talking about for patentability. Right? And it's hard to know whether they would have invested without the possibility of having a patent, right? I think the best way to sum this up is there's a very important book that all of you should read by Hal Varian, who's now the chief economist at Google, used to be at UC Berkeley, and Carl Haas, who's still at Berkeley, called Information Rules. Right? It's about essentially, you know, business strategies in the digital or information age. And they say very little about intellectual property. Here's the only thing they say about intellectual property, and I wish I could get people to remember this. They said, you are in business to make money. Sometimes you make money by enforcing intellectual property. Sometimes you make money by giving intellectual property away. The point is not to enforce intellectual property. The point is to make money. So do whatever makes money. You know, your lawyer may tell you you need to enforce your patent. Your knee-jerk reaction may be to enforce your patent. But if that's not going to make you money, then don't enforce your patent. Give the technology away. Right? You know, but remember, your purpose as a business is to make money, not to enforce intellectual property. And I guess we'll stop with that.